I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai is urging Afghans to get out and vote tomorrow. Despite security concerns and threats from the Taliban against those who do vote, the country is going ahead with parliamentary elections that were originally scheduled for May, but were postponed because of security and financial concerns, as well as logistical challenges. But have things really changed? Last year's presidential contest was riddled with fraud and violence, and a group called the Free and Fair Elections Foundation of Afghanistan has counted 19 recent election-related deaths, four of whom were candidates. And speaking of candidates, there are 2,500 of them. Joining us from Kabul now is Ben Arnoldy. He's South Asia Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Ben, welcome.
Thank you.
The British NATO commander in southern Afghanistan, Major General Nick Carter, says he is not optimistic that things will go smoothly. He says the best he's hoping for is less violence than last year. And then on the other hand, the Interior Ministry in Afghanistan is saying security is fine and is encouraging people to come out and vote in force. How do you see the security situation?
On the security front, the Election Commission here in Afghanistan has made a decision to close polling centers in areas that they knew they couldn't protect. And that decision was made much earlier this time around than during the presidential election last year. So that should help keep voters out of the crosshairs a bit. But I think there's no denying that the security situation has eroded even from last year. Last year's election, it was one of the most violent days since the beginning of the war. And I think there's expectations among a broad array of experts that that may happen again.
So if they're closing polling centers, will there be enough centers open to actually accommodate everybody who does venture out to vote?
No, there will be disenfranchisement because of that decision. There will be people who live in insecure areas who will not have a chance to vote. And there will be candidates whose home districts are those insecure areas and who will probably face a much harder time getting reelected or elected.
As I mentioned, the Taliban is threatening violence against those who do even try to vote. Are you finding that people are generally afraid?
I've been talking to people around Kabul, and there's a security bubble in Kabul that makes it different from the provinces. Here, there isn't much concern about personal safety. There is concern that their vote is a complete waste of time, that in fact, from what they saw in previous elections, particularly last year's presidential vote, there's a sense that the winners are already fixed.
Well, have problems associated with fraud been fixed or addressed in any way?
So there have been changes. The person who is in charge of the Independent Election Commission, there seems to be broad consensus that he's more serious about cracking down on this. Whereas the other body that sort of handles complaints that come up during the election, that body is seen as severely watered down. There's been no adequate attempt to clean up the voter registration rolls. In fact, there's reports that people are printing out voter registration cards and selling them and printing out ballots as well. One of the problems that created a lot of the fraud in the presidential election was at the last second, a lot of polling stations were closed, and then later on, as the vote was being counted and manipulated, the votes from those stations would suddenly reappear. So giving extra time this time around allowed some of that to be declared much more early and up front, and so that should help a little bit. But there's all these overriding problems that have really not been tackled very adequately since last year's election.
In fact, last year's runner-up in the presidential race, Abdullah Abdullah, said, yes, go out, vote in massive numbers, but then later admitted in the day that they'll likely see fraud, widespread fraud and violence, so at least he's not optimistic.
Right, and I think his take on that is that at least if you go out and vote, there will be more legitimate votes in the system. You know, fraud becomes worse and worse the more the turnout is low because there's all kinds of empty, unfilled out ballots at each polling station. And in those ballots, that's huge temptation for the people working there to fill them out and to stuff the ballot box. So the more people who do come out, theoretically, the cleaner the election. And so that's partly why he's making that call.
That's Ben Arnoldy, South Asia Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, joining me from Kabul. Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Turning now from the elections in Afghanistan to the man who claims he was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks that led to the war there. Journalist Terry McDermott says whenever, wherever Khalid Sheikh Mohammed goes on trial, his answers to questions about the attacks will be deeply unsatisfying. That one of the most famous terrorists in the world seems to have had no grand strategy, or really any strategy at all. Terry McDermott's story about Mohammed, who has been held in Guantanamo Bay since 2006, is in the New Yorker magazine, and he joins us from NPR West. Terry, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much for having me.
You write that most people see Mohammed as a brilliant, behind-the-scenes tactician and a resolute ideologue. What is wrong with that image of him?
It's too flattering in many ways. What is more true about him than anything is there's this kind of anarchic, almost feral quality to what he's done for most of his life. He hits on a target almost by his eyes lighting on something, if you know what I mean. He and his nephew, Remzi Youssef Abdul Basit, his actual name, everywhere they went, they walked down the street, they saw targets they wanted to kill. He didn't seem to be a great ideologue whatsoever, that it was just this need to blow things up, to kill people, rather than to do it in the service of something.
One thing that really jumped out at me in your story was your reporting on the connection between Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped and eventually killed in Pakistan in 2002. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, if there's anything that illustrates the sort of the wanton nature of Khalid Sheikh's crimes, it's that. He had no idea who Daniel Pearl was. And when the first stories came out that he might have been involved, I thought, that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, he's got enough going on, right? He's at that point trying to run Al-Qaeda's field operations around the world, plotting to blow up nightclubs in Bali, synagogues in Tunisia. He's going to personally kill a Wall Street Journal reporter. But now the Pakistani police have an explanation for this, which makes much sense to me. They say the people who were accused of kidnapping Pearl are actually the people who did it. They're a bunch of local jihadis who were kind of in the kidnap for ransom business. And Pearl was an inviting target. He was a Westerner. They thought they could get some money for him. It got way bigger than they ever anticipated. They didn't think it was going to attract any attention. And word in the jihadi underground spreads, and Khalid Sheikh, who's been living in Karachi off and on for 10 years, hears about it, gets a hold of the people who have him. He says, here, I'll take care of it for you. I'll give you 50 grand for the guy. And they go, okay, great. He's yours. He gives him $50,000 and cuts his head off. That just leaves me utterly speechless. Why?
Well, what is the answer? He basically bought him.
He bought him, but I mean, to what end? I mean, that's what this leads me to, this notion of the pathologies that's at work here.
There is a photo of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed along with your story in The New Yorker. We all remember the picture of him when he was captured in Pakistan in 2003. Scruffy, heavy, looked like he just gotten out of bed. When I saw this newer photo in your piece, the thing that struck me was how much he looked like Osama bin Laden. He lost weight. He has a long beard. First of all, what's the story behind that picture? I don't remember photos like that being taken of other Guantanamo detainees.
That photograph was taken by the International Red Cross in 2009 after many years of seeking to be allowed to take pictures back to the families of the Guantanamo detainees. There's an eerie quality to the picture. I mean, there's this sort of beatific glance that he has. In any case, they were taken in 2009 and given back to, they were the first photographs that people had seen of their loved ones. Hard to think of these guys as being anybody's loved ones, but they are. Khalid Sheikh has six kids.
Well, some media that's picking up your story is presenting it almost like he is making a deliberate attempt to change his image, which I know you don't believe.
But
you do write that he has a certain amount of vanity, that he once complained to a sketch artist during one of his hearings at Guantanamo that his nose had been drawn too big.
He's not the one who gave me the picture. I got it from relatives in Pakistan. They weren't told by him to give me the picture. You know what I mean? It's ludicrous.
I mentioned Osama bin Laden, who, of course, has not been captured. But remind us what we know about Mohammed's connection to bin Laden.
Khalid Sheikh, as you mentioned, there's a great amount of vanity at work here, and it extended to his relationship with bin Laden as well. When he first proposed the plan to bin Laden, the 9/11 plan, he saw the meeting as a meeting of equals. that they were two entrepreneurs of terror. And he, Khalid, had the ideas and bin Laden had the money, the resources to fund them. And when bin Laden eventually agreed to the plan, an altered version of the plan, he allowed Khalid to more or less run it, but then he kept interfering. And it just drove Khalid Sheikh crazy.
Because he was so impatient, right?
Right. Khalid Sheikh had allowed the Muhammad Atta, the lead pilot, to basically set the timing, the dates, et cetera, when the attacks would occur. And the criteria for that were when the teams, the hijacked teams, were in place and ready to go. This is an aside, but the most remarkable part of 9/11 is that over 4 years of attempting, Khalid Sheikh was only able to get 19 guys into the United States to take part in this. There was no lack of guys wanting to do it. They had what he called a surplus in the martyrs department. There were lots of people who were willing to be suicide bombers, but they just couldn't get into the country.
There's also a lingering question about why Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was not taken into custody before the 9/11 attacks even happened. U.S. officials knew that he was connected to that first bombing at the World Trade Center back in 1993. In fact, he was secretly indicted for that in 96. But at the same time, you write that former head of the CIA, Michael Hayden, told a Senate committee that Mohammed didn't even appear in the CIA chart of key al-Qaeda members until a detainee identified him as a planner of 9/11 in 2002. Can you account for that disconnect?
My jaw dropped when I read that testimony. I was stunned. You know, I'll tell you how bad it was, though. He was first publicly identified, Khalid Sheikh, as an instrumental part of the 9/11 plan in June of 2002. Myself and two colleagues, by the end of the week, had gotten hold of his immigration papers, where he'd gone to college. I saw an FBI report in 2003 where they were still trying to figure out where I went to school. That perplexes me. It's astonishing. I don't know what they're doing. It's even worse than it looks, I think. Part of it's human nature. Bin Laden was the big fish, and once he came along, everybody else was sort of pushed into the background. But, you know, Khalid Sheikh was indicted for trying to kill 3,000 Americans. It's a crime for which other people are serving 240-year sentences now. To not pursue him as vigorously as you could, I find it's inexplicable.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the self-described mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Journalist Terry McDermott's new article about Mohammed details his childhood in Kuwait, the years he spent in college in North Carolina, and his turn toward terrorism. The story, which appears in The New Yorker, also focuses on Mohammed's life in the maximum security prison at Guantanamo Bay, where he's been held since 2006. Terry, in the story, you paint a picture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's behavior during the hearings that he's attended at Guantanamo, where he is defending himself. In those hearings, he's compared himself to George Washington. He's testified that he planned the 9/11 attacks from A to Z. And you say another reporter said he performed like a comedian, like comedian Jackie Mason, during one of the hearings. I wish you'd tell us more about what it's like to watch him in one of those hearings.
Yeah, you know, he's this weird presence. He's a small guy. I always thought of him as being big because of the stoutness, I guess. All the early pictures, including the famous one of the night of the capture, he looks pretty good. He looks good size, large. But he's not, and especially now that he's lost weight, he's tiny. He's this frail little figure, but who nonetheless commands the room. All the other detainees don't do anything without looking to him first. He always sits in the front row. He monitors what they say. He tries to persuade them his way, and usually if they come back the next day, they will have agreed with him. He can be comical at times. There was an instance where he was, during the presiding officer was trying to read an order, And Khalid apparently was bored and stood up and started chanting a Quranic verse. And the officer said, please, you know, sit down. And he just kept going. It's happened two or three times. And he was singing in this kind of melodic, deeper voice. And finally the guy says, please, this is it. And he looks up at him and goes, okay, and sits down. He has this weird affect. You know, his voice is very high-pitched. So you got this little guy with this high-pitched voice, nonetheless commanding attention. It kind of works against the idea of what we have of somebody's physical, powerful presence.
What's going to happen to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
You know, I can't believe they're not going to try him. Otherwise, why would they have waited? The rumors are that the administration will announce its intent after the midterm elections, so in November or December. And if they're waiting for that, that means they're waiting for they want to avoid any political fallout. The only political fallout would occur is if they're going to try him in federal court. So I assume that they're going to do that. And if that's the case, he can only be tried in one of the venues where the crimes were committed. So that would be New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. If I had to guess, I would guess that it's going to be in Virginia. But that's just a pure guess.
And what would any trial look like? I mean, he is the self-proclaimed architect of 9/11. How would the government build its case?
You know, that's a difficult problem. I mean, you know, thank God, I guess, that he's going to plead guilty, which he says he wants to do. He wants to be a martyr. Otherwise, you know, they've really poisoned the well of evidence with the torture that's occurred. You can't ever make these guys clean again. They've tried. You know, they've gone in and tried to reinvestigate all of the individuals with so-called clean teams of people who weren't involved in the original interrogations to try to see if they could recreate the evidence that they obtained under torture. And apparently with enough success that they think that they can proceed along those lines. Whether a jury was going to accept that or not is another question. It's, you know, among all the reasons that torture is a bad idea, it follows up everything you want to do afterward. You don't know. You can't trust the information you get. You can't use the information you get. You know, you can't then get other information, even if you're not torturing them. It's a foolhardy thing.
Terry McDermott, you've been digging into this story for a long time. I'm curious what questions you still have about 9/11.
I want to know when I can get a good night's sleep. I've been dreaming about this stuff for years, and I'd like it to go away. The most serious question I have about it, I, along with many others, I think, felt after 9/11 that we were probably going to live in an age where something like this was bound to occur every so often. That it wasn't that hard to do. And terrorism is not hard to do. It just takes a terrorist, and there are many of them, and a little bit of money, which can be moved anywhere in the world. And so I thought that we would be experiencing something like Israel and the Intifada, where, you know, every other weekend a shopping mall would blow up. That hasn't happened, obviously, and it's a thrill that it hasn't. But I would like to know where I miscalculated, where we miscalculated. What's different about the world that hasn't happened? Have we just been lucky? Perhaps. I really don't know. It's a genuine question to me.
Terry McDermott, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for talking with me.
That's Terry McDermott. He's the author of Perfect Soldiers, The Hijackers, Who They Were, Why They Did It. And his new story about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed appears in The New Yorker. Was it or wasn't it a tornado that touched down in New York City last night?
First, the house shook, the lights went out, we heard a rumbling noise, the trees started falling, my entire hood is completely crushed down, my trunk is completely crushed down, my side is crushed.
When I looked, I saw my garbage can go flying over the fence. Yeah. Then I looked out the window, everything was black.
I ran outside down the block by the local delicatessen. These stores are blown in, windows broken everywhere, rooftops blown off, trees are split in half. Motorcycles flipped over, cars broken windows, bricks on top of cars.
A powerful storm blew through Queens, Staten Island, and Brooklyn, killing at least one person and creating chaos for commuters. The National Weather Service told us earlier they won't know until later today whether it was indeed a tornado, which would be extremely rare. Only 8 twisters have touched down in New York City in the past 60 years. Rochelle Boone is a reporter for New York One. She's in Middle Village in Queens, one of the worst hit areas. Rochelle, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What sort of damage are you seeing there?
We're seeing a lot of serious damage here. This is an area that prides itself on the amount of trees that it has here, and a lot of these trees have been uprooted. Some of them have fallen on homes, some of them on cars. A lot of residents here are trying to assess the situation this morning. The power is out, so a lot of people are not able to move around right now. But it's just really devastating right here.
We understand that in Manhattan last night at Penn Station, it was a mob scene after the Long Island Railway canceled service. What was the impact on commuters?
Oh, forget about it. Actually, it didn't only impact the railways. It also had a huge impact on the roadways, because when people could not get on the trains, they tried to go by car service or hitch a ride with a friend, and the highways were jam-packed. I myself, it took me 3 hours on a local highway to get home with a ride that would have normally taken me 10 minutes.
We heard people describe the damage there, but what are they saying today about the storm and about repairing all of it?
Well, there's a lot of talk among the residents. Was this a tornado? Was it not a tornado? A lot of residents are making up their own minds. They think it's a tornado that did this kind of damage. A lot of people here say they have never seen anything like this before, and this storm is quite devastating. I've traveled through a lot of areas this morning, another section, Corona. They were quite devastated. Forest Hills, that they were hit pretty hard, Flushing. So just a lot of residents trying to deal with the magnitude of this. But this morning, we're seeing people doing a lot of cleanup and a lot of people taking pictures.
We mentioned New York City has only had 8 tornadoes in the last 60 years. The most recent one was in July. So if last night's storm turns out to be a tornado as well, what are people saying about having 2 twisters so close together?
Unbelievable. One guy said to me, it's incredible. It's something like out of the scene of Wizard of Oz. So, you know, a lot of people here are just trying to come to grips with this, because this is really not the sort of thing that happens on a regular basis in New York City. We've heard about things like this in other states and, you know, other parts of the country, but we've never really experienced anything like this to this kind of magnitude.
And when are you expecting things to get back to normal there?
Oh, boy, it's hard to put a time frame on that, because right now sanitation crews are having a hard time getting a handle on all of this. I've been out and about since 4 o'clock this morning, and crews were out there long before that trying to remove some of the debris. They moved trees and branches from the major roadways, but a lot of the side streets still are, we're seeing a lot of damage there.
I know New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been in the middle of this. What has he been saying to people in New York and beyond?
Yeah, he's been trying to calm the nerves of residents. People were really shaken up by this, especially people who were sitting in their cars and in their homes when, you know, trees fell on them. And he's been trying to reassure New Yorkers that, thankfully, most of us are okay. There was only one fatality on the Grand Central Parkway when a tree fell on a woman's car. It killed her. Her passenger survived. But he's trying to tell New Yorkers this could have been much worse. The fatality could have been much worse. So we should just all hang in there and try to help each other at this point.
Rochelle Boone covers Queens for New York One. She joined us with the latest on the powerful storm that swept through New York City last night. Rochelle, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You may have heard that a technology university in Pennsylvania is blacking out social media sites such as Twitter, instant messaging, and Facebook for 1 week and requiring students to write a reflective essay about the experiment. Well, Harrisburg University of Science and Technology even became the butt of late-night TV jokes because of it. After all, students do have their own smartphones to get on Facebook. Let's hear about it now from one student, Pawi Wadishwaran. Hi, Pawi.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Well, I'm well. How are you? The week's not over yet. What do you think of this experiment? Has it been good?
Yeah, it's been pretty good. I'm pretty optimistic about the whole idea. Like, in today's electronic world, being social is completely a different thing rather than how it would have been like a couple of decades ago. Like, the number of friends you have on Facebook, the number of tweets you send a day, that's what counts, whether you're social or not. And this whole experiment, I wouldn't say it's going to change anything, but it's sort of giving an opportunity for the students to self-evaluate themselves, to see where they stand, to see how they've been enslaved by the media. And I'm liking it, and I feel it's given me more time to just sit on my schoolwork and not to just be so tempted enough to check the Facebook, like, every single second. So
you like it. What are the other students saying? I mean, heaven forbid they actually have to talk to each other.
Yeah, but students are eventually trying to understand the whole idea, the concept behind the experiment. I think it's sort of turning around, but of course, there are a couple of students who are like, oh my gosh, I'm not able to check my Facebook. I'm not able to tweet. How bad could this be?
The school's provost says this is not a punishment. It's not a precursor to a ban of any sort. But why would a technology school want to do this?
It's not just to deprive the students of the social media, but like sort of doing it by virtue of it, the students get to know the value of it.
So be honest. Are you going to be happy when this experiment is over? You can get back to socializing online?
Sort of. I still am a social person. Like, I have a lot of, you know, online presence, but I'm not the one who would be like, oh my gosh, I need to check this. It really doesn't make a big difference to me personally.
Pawi Wadishwaran is a senior who will graduate from Harrisburg University of Science and Technology this December with a degree in computer science information. Pawi, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me here.
This next story begins with a song that was all over the 2009 Oscar ceremony. Jai-ho! 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 That's Jai-ho from the sleeper hit film Slumdog Millionaire. Last year, that song and the soundtrack to the film won our next guest 2 Academy Awards and made him a celebrity in the U.S. But A.R. Rahman was a superstar in his native India well before that. He wrote his first film score in 1992 and pretty much has not stopped. Top Indian film directors seek him out. India's top singers do too. His work has been featured in more than 100 films. On top of his film work, he's on the U.S. leg of a world tour now. He joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
What did those 2 Academy Awards mean to you?
I mean, it's a dream for any person to get an Oscar. And sometimes it feels that you've completed your life, but I think there are more bigger issues in life and bigger challenges to face now, and that's what I'm looking at.
Let's talk about your earlier work. Roja was your first film score, and it became an instant hit. Time magazine called it one of the top 10 movie soundtracks of all time. I want to play some of that score for our listeners. Here's the song Choti Si Asha, which means a little bit of hope.
Dil hai chota sa, choti si asha.
Am I hearing a little reggae in that, Mr. Rahman?
Yeah, it is reggae. I used to play film music from the age of 13, 12, or whatever. I got sick of every kind of style which existed in India, and I wanted to do something else.
You've worked with British musician M.I.A. The two of you collaborated on the song Osea from Slumdog Millionaire, and I want to hear a little bit of that now. You bring strands of so many different types of contemporary music from all around the world into your work. I'm curious, did any American artists influence you as a young musician in India?
Yeah, when I was in school, some of my high school schoolmates played me Deep Purple and America and all these bands. And apart from that, artists like Barbra Streisand, Carpenters, I wanted to get away from South Indian folk music and start listening to all kinds of stuff. I never knew that all of them would come as influences my palette of sounds later. It was out of just to take away my mind.
I want to listen to another song from a film score that you wrote. This is Opalan Hare from the film Lagan. Here's that one.
Opalan Hare Nirgun O Nyare Tumhre Bin Hamra Kono Nahi.
Mr. Rehman, I know your story is fascinating. You converted to Islam in your early 20s. You are a Sufi. You're here in the U.S. at a time when there's so much talk about Islam in our country. And I'm just curious how you weigh in on issues like the Islamic Center in New York, proposed near Ground Zero. You know, the Christian pastor, should he be allowed to burn a Koran? Are Americans Islamophobic? I mean, you must be hearing all of this. And I'm wondering what you think about it.
Well, if you take about any religion, it's almost like an instruction manual for human beings. That's what the Bible did. That's what the Quran then came out later. And in my opinion, I think if you understand the essence of religion, it's about love. Though it's a cliche, that's the truth, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do through my music. And that's what spirituality has to give to you, not split people and not aggravate people and not make people angry and kill each other. So I'm going beyond all that stuff in this concert series. Music plays in a very different context. It kind of unifies people. My performers are half American here, and they're Indians, Hindu, Muslim, Sikh people. And here in this concert, we celebrate every religion. There is, it gives us all happiness, and it unites us. And in a way, this tour is a big statement for all of us.
Well, we are grateful for your time today, sir. Thank you very much, and for all your music. We are grateful.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. That's Frank Zappa performing his 1980s song, What's New in Baltimore. And what is new in Baltimore is that Sunday is Frank Zappa Day. The Charm City native is being honored for his music and his crusade to defend the First Amendment, butting heads with the government over censorship. Zappa was particularly angered by the goals of Tipper Gore's group, the Parents Music Resource Center, for their attempts in 1985 to censor pop music. The group created the Filthy 15, a list of songs they deemed particularly offensive. Number one on the list, Prince's hit song, Darling Nikki.
I knew a girl named Nikki, I guess you could say she was a sex fiend. I met her in a hotel lobby, masturbating with a magazine.
Sunday is the 25th anniversary of Frank Zappa's Senate committee testimony where he spoke out against the Washington Wives' endeavors to clean up the music industry.
Taken as a whole, the complete list of PMRC demands reads like an instruction manual for some sinister kind of toilet training program to housebreak all composers and performers because of the lyrics of a few. Ladies, how dare you?
Zappa died in 1993 of prostate cancer, but Frank Zappa Day in Baltimore is intended to be a reminder that his art and his ideas live on. Joining us from the studios of NPR West is Frank Zappa's widow, Gail Zappa. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Remind us of the nation's mood back in 1985. Why were some people very upset about what they were hearing on the airwaves and seeing on MTV?
Well, I don't know if I can speak about the mood in particular, because that's something you can whip up. You can get people frenzied in any number of ways, as you can see now all the time. But in those days, the issue about lyrics was really about a story that the media didn't want to touch, and it was about a taped tax bill on blank tape. So it was a private tax for a private industry that the record industry would benefit from and was expecting the government to help them out. And in order to get that passed, the RIAA had to bend over quite significantly and give up certain rights to the art that belonged to the artist, really. And that's the story that you don't hear, but we are releasing a record of the testimony, and you will hopefully hear it all over again if you didn't hear it then.
Let's listen to a bit of Frank Zappa's remarks before the Senate committee.
While the wife of the Secretary of Treasury recites, "Gonna drive my love inside you," and Senator Gore's wife talks about bondage, people in high places work on a tax bill that is so ridiculous, the only way to sneak it through is to keep the public's mind on something else. Porn rock.
So after those hearings, after that testimony, 19 record companies agreed to put parental guidance, explicit lyrics labels on music that they deemed offensive, much like the warnings that we see on music download websites today. Did Frank Zappa feel like he'd failed in his efforts to defend artists' rights, or was he satisfied to let consumers decide to heed the warnings or not?
Well, you know, it is about artists' rights, but more importantly, it's about the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. That's really what he was defending as a citizen of the United States. And to the extent that labeling records, because originally the plan was to put V for violence and O for obscene and those sorts of labels on records, not the generic one that everyone seems to be familiar with now. So he just felt that it was outrageous, and that was virtual censorship of artists' rights to share their ideas with their audience.
What did he say about his decision to testify in Congress, to take on this issue? Because his career did take a hit afterward, didn't it?
Well, I would say that his career was always taking a hit. I mean, Frank was virtually banned from radio and certainly television, and most especially primetime TV. You would never see Frank Zappa, and you would very rarely hear him on the radio unless it was a college radio station. So yes, the answer about taking a particular hit, that's true, because his record contract got shredded immediately thereafter.
Do warnings about censorship back in 1985, do they ring true today? I mean, you put on a CD or turn on the TV, and it seems that compared to 1985, at least, the censors have gone on vacation. I mean, anything goes.
What do you mean, gone on vacation? Who put them in charge in the first place? Why do we need them?
So that's how you see it.
Yeah. I mean, why are we messing around with people's right to freedom of speech? I'm from a generation where it started with comic books and comics, people like Lenny Bruce, for example, and earlier than that, not being allowed access to the potential audience out there because the media was all controlled. Now you have a situation with the internet where it is not controlled, and it's much easier for artists to make their statements, and people are far more accepting of hearing those ideas in vernacular.
I want to play a bit of one of the current mega music hits of the day. It's called "Love the Way You Lie" by Eminem and Rihanna. The song is part confessional. It's a look at Eminem's own long and violent relationship with his ex-wife, Kim. Here it is.
Just gonna stand there and watch me.
Gail, you hear the words of that song. Just going to stand there and watch me burn. That's all right because I like the way it hurts. Many women and women's groups are quite disturbed about the song's theme. They say it glorifies domestic violence. Does it worry you at all? And can you venture on what Frank Zappa would have to say about this song? Would he think that it goes too far?
If you're asking me personally how do I feel about the lyrics for this particular song, I think that it's great that people can hear from the artists themselves, how they feel about a particular situation. If you are in an abusive relationship and you can listen to that song with the person that's abusing you, I think it's really important because it saves you having to open up and talk directly to that person and risk further abuse. You can share that song and they can hear how you feel and know it.
I think that a lot of people believe kids are influenced by these lyrics, and that's the concern. But Gail, this weekend you'll be presenting your views on censorship at a symposium in Baltimore, part of the Frank Zappa Day festivities. We hear a statue of your late husband will be unveiled. It's a replica of one erected by fans in Vilnius, Lithuania.
I'm very excited to see the statue again. I saw it first in Vilnius myself, and so now it's installed in Baltimore, and it'll be unveiled there. And then my son, Dweezil, is going to be playing his band, Zappa Plays Zappa, will be playing, and then there will be this ceremony right in the middle of there somewhere.
What would Frank think of all the fuss?
I think he'd be laughing it's very funny, it's very amusing, and it's way too little, way too late.
That's Gail Zappa, widow of the late Frank Zappa. She'll be speaking in Baltimore on Sunday as the city pays honor to her late husband with a celebration of Frank Zappa Day, marking the 25th anniversary of his congressional testimony against music censorship. Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Jane Clayson. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. And please join us again here and now.